Israel,
one of the most subtle and one of the most crucial jobs for Americans in today's troubled world is to get across to people all over the world simply and convincingly what we are for. You know, we Americans are sometimes hurt and puzzled by the wildly inaccurate ideas that people seem to have about us. When we travel or when other people come over here like Mr. Khrushchev, and you say, well, they can't see very much difference between the raw capitalism of Marxist time and present private enterprise and so forth. I even saw a poll not too terribly long ago indicating that most of the people of India thought that the United States was a greater threat to peace than the Soviet Union. Well, one primary reason, in my opinion, for this very unsatisfactory state of affairs is that in the crucial, precious years since World War II, when this so-called battle of ideas was taking form, we consumed too much of our idea ammunition in being against. Though we knew what we were against, that was easy. It was communism. And so many of our finest programs and activities were justified to the people and the Congress in negative terms. We must have an overseas information program. Why? To counter the Soviet propaganda program. We must have an overseas cultural program. Why? To counter the communist cultural offensive. We must have an overseas economic program. Why? To counter the Soviet economic thrust, and so on and on. It's so easy to be against, to go on the defensive. The next impression, however, left by all of this, is that the active, positive force in the world is international communism, while we, by contrast, represent a sort of amorphous, ill-defined force for countering change. Now, the trouble with this is that most people in the world want change. They're not satisfied with their lives and their conditions. You can't blame them. And so if we get maneuvered into the position of being anti-change, while the communists are pro-change, we enter any competition for the hearts and the minds of men with an absolutely hopeless handicap. Now the truth is that what we are for is, in fact, the active, positive force in the world. The American pioneering success in practical political democracy and rapid industrial progress for years has been the explosive idea inspiring other countries and colonies all around the world. Well, then, why should we get maneuvered into this position in which we seem to yield to the communists the role of active force in the world? Well, frequently heard explanation runs like this. People say, well, the communists have got a nice, tidy, single panacea that they can wrap up in a single package and peddle it as a cure for all the world's ills, from poverty and hunger to oppression and war. But we, by contrast, so the excuse runs, but what we are for is so diverse, we simply can't wrap it up and hold it forth as an affirmative ideology. What are we for? Well, capitalism, says the businessman. Rule of law, says the lawyer. Representative democratic government, says the political scientist. Primacy of the individual, says the philosopher. Religion, says the preacher, and so on. And some writers like Walter Lippmann, for example, in The Good Society, in their zeal to contrast our society with the plan from above societies of the dictators, conclude that an ultimate direction and goal in our type of society can simply never be taken. Well, tonight I'm going to venture a switch on this idea of ideological disadvantage. If by ideology is meant a set of principles which first have some claim to originality, and second some relation to reality, then the ideological advantage is all with us. We have an ideology which we have never articulated. The communists have articulated an ideology which in fact doesn't exist. Now, to develop this thesis, I could choose many different areas and fields, but I'm going to limit myself to one proving ground, and that is really the essence of the modern political economic problem of emerging societies and industrializing societies. The economic problem in relation to the individual, the relation of government to people, to business, to labor, and so on. In all these newly developing countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, this is the idea that seems to upset them. They are determined to reach a new standard of education, culture, sanitation, health, standard of living generally. And the determination to become associated with the Soviet or the American way of thinking will probably turn more on what they think of the relative ability of these ideologies to solve their economic problem than on any other. You know, we got very accustomed to the industrial age, the atomic age, the space age. We're inclined to forget that two-thirds of the people of the world are still living under conditions not essentially different from 5,000 years ago. This was told to me not too long ago by Arnold Toynbee in a private conversation. And I questioned him again and again, and he assures me that it's still so, in spite of all the progress we've heard about. South Asia, Southeast Asia, and most of these countries, average per capita income varies between a dime and a quarter a day. But now this 5,000-year streak has been broken. And through travel, and through education, and through modern communication, these people are beginning to find out what they've missed, and they're determined to do something about it. And recognizing all this, the Soviet Union makes this kind of appeal. They say, look at us. A few decades ago, we too were an agrarian country just like this. Now we're an industrial and scientific giant. Oh, yes, the United States is a scientific and industrial giant, too, but they had 150 years. You haven't got that kind of time. You better cast in your lot with us. Now, if they succeed in this line of argument, I'm afraid the other parts of the ideological argument won't help much. But let's be clear what we're trying to do in relation to these emergent countries. We're not trying to get them to imitate us, or to emulate us, or to like us, or even to love us. This would be presumptuous as well as impossible. What we really are getting at is best summed up in one word, I think, identification. We want to get a feeling of we, not we and they. But you see, the first step in the process of identification is that you've got to understand yourself. Then the other fellow, then you see the common elements so that you can see the ties that bind you together. And in my opinion, the first and the greatest obstacle to making this identification with the people of other countries is of our own making. It's our own failure or refusal to understand what we really are and what we really stand for. And by creating an image of ourselves that is in itself absolutely unreal, we make it impossible for them to identify themselves with us. Now let me explain what I mean by using a specific example. There have been many books and pamphlets and even college courses on the subject of what we are for. A good example came out several years ago, a book by Russell Kirk entitled The American Cause. Now this book is eloquent on the great familiar principles of individuality, private enterprise, liberty, and so forth. As Chesterton said, when comparing the works of George Bernard Shaw to the Venus de Milo, everything that is there is perfect. But the omission, you see, the omission leaves an impression that is so out of date as to be dangerously misleading. You could read this entire book, and many others like it, and you would never realize that the United States government does, in fact, regulate, police, stimulate, and even subsidize American industry and agriculture in a thousand ways, large and small. You could read the entire book. You'd never know that social insurance exists in the United States, much less that it has the most generous and one of the most elaborate systems in the world. You'd be quite unaware of the vital roles played by organized labor, by federal tax credit and fiscal policy, and by such agencies as the FTC and the FCC and the FTC and the ICC and the SEC and the AEC and the CAA and the CAB and the FCA and the HHSA and NLRB and the RRB and the VA and the SBA. The economics of this book are much closer to Adam Smith than to J.K. Galbraith. The agriculture is closer to the Homestead Act than the oil bank. And as for labor, we're made to seem closer to Walden Pond than the Wagner Labor Relations Act. Now, suppose we go to a country like India with this picture of what we are for, a sort of an ineffable distillation of the purest, untrammeled private enterprise with a laissez-faire government standing benevolently by. What can India say? She'll be driven to say, well, this may have worked for you, but it cannot possibly work for us. India has few capitalists, very few of the ingredients of a self-started, self-propelled private enterprise system. She can't possibly realize her ambition of an industrial economy and other developments without a high degree of governmental involvement. Therefore, if we create the impression, expressly or impliedly, that a high degree of governmental involvement puts the system beyond the pale so far as we're concerned, our hopes of identification will have been shattered. Now, if we ever get things in this posture, we'll be guilty of one of history's most unnecessary blunders. For the actual fact is that we do have a principle. Indeed, the guiding principle of our government, business, individual relationship, it applies equally well to India and to ourselves. And it should serve as the common ideological denominator for the newer countries all around the world. The heart of the concept lies in a quotation from Lincoln, which has lately become one of his best known statements. Runs like this. The function of government is to do for people what needs to be done. But what they cannot of themselves do at all or do so well. Now, when you transplant this principle to India, you find, first of all, that there's much more that has to be done for people. And second, that there's a much higher proportion of it that they can't do for themselves than only the government can do. But the principle is just as valid, though the facts are changing. Now, this is not socialism. In fact, it's the opposite of socialism. It's the best antidote to socialism in today's world. A socialist is a person who says, if something needs to be done for people, other things being equal, let the government do it. The Lincoln formula says, if something needs to be done for people, other things being equal,
let it be done privately.
But if it must be done, and only the government can do it, then let the government not hesitate to do it. Now there's a third choice, that of the reactionary. The reactionary says, if something needs to be done for people, for their health, their education, their welfare, and it cannot be done privately, and only the government can do it, just don't do it at all. Well, this then is not socialism. Creeping or any other case. Not classical capitalism either, of the time of Marx 100 or more years ago. And it's not going down the road to one or the other. It's something in itself. And it's made in America. It's what we call the law, tertium quid. It's something different from any of the customary bipolar political entities that we hear so much about. Now, why is it? Back in the days of classical capitalism and socialism, only one force counted so far as the capitalists were concerned, and that was business. And along came the socialists. And they agreed, too, that there could only be one force, but it had to be government. And a third element came along, it's been added in the interval, strong organized labor. Now, the old view was based on the concept of inherent enmity between business on the one hand and the other two elements on the other. The class struggle between capital and labor was accepted as a fact of life by both sides, not just the communists. At the one extreme, the fanatical communists were perfectly willing to burn the plant down despite the employer, even if it cost them their job. At the other extreme, the classical capitalists was supposed to have no interest in labor at all except to wring out of them as much as he could for the least wage and then throw them in the scrap heap. Similarly, as to the relation between government and business, both sides agreed that the relationship was or ought to be one of enmity. The employers dealt with government on the theory that any contract of government with business was necessarily an evil and a poisonous thing. The socialists agreed, but they expressed it the other way around, that the government should take over and destroy business. Now, it seems to me that the distinctive contribution of American thought and experience is this, that these three great elements in modern industrial society, labor, business, and government, are not inherently antagonistic. Rightly led, and with an intelligent sense of self-interest all around, recognizing their proper roles and playing them out, these three elements can raise and have raised the standards of production and prosperity to levels much higher than could be attained by any one of them if you gave that one even unlimited power. Let me give two or three examples. Most businessmen used to assume almost automatically that they had to be opposed to the social insurance, such as Social Security, workman's compensation, unemployment insurance, and so forth. Most of them by now have pretty well come around to the view that a modern private enterprise economy simply could not exist without social insurance. Our present level of economic activity is largely consumer-based. The level of consumer buying insurance is very heavily dependent upon installment finance, particularly as to the larger items. Installment buying insurance is dependent upon social insurance, because wage earners could never undertake their present types of commitment over a period of 18 months or 18 years, without the assurance that if their wages are interrupted by any of these exigencies, injuries, unemployment, and so forth, that they won't lose both the commodity and their pension. The causal chain is perfectly clear. Social insurance is not merely helpful, it is absolutely indispensable to a modern consumer-based mass production economy. Similarly, the whole complex known as government regulation, or government interference, depending on your point of view, turns out on analysis to be essential to the functioning and the prospering of our type of industrial society. How could there be a television industry, for example, unless the government regulated and assigned channels? The channels were grabbed on an every man for himself basis. The industry soon smothered itself under a blanket of screeching, howling, overlapping stitches. The air would be even more hideous than it already is. How could our packaged food and drugs and cosmetic industry flourish without government regulation? Who would buy a sealed jar of pickles or a sealed bottle of shampoo without the confidence born of government laws and enforcement of the Food and Drug Act that the pickles won't poison them and the shampoo won't burn your scalp off? Who would ride in a commercial aircraft without the assurance that goes with government ordering of traffic and enforcement of safety standards and the like? You could multiply examples all up and down the roster of modern goods and services. What really comes down to is this. In simpler terms, customers bought his pickles from a pickle barrel. Go up to the pickle barrel and he didn't need any Food and Drug Act. He just reached in and took one out and looked at it, rolled it on his finger, smelled it, listened to it. If he didn't like it, he could throw it back in the barrel for the next show. But if you want to have an economy that sells its pickles and sealed jars, you've got to have a certain amount of governmental involvement. Or to put it in another way, under a laissez-faire concept of industry and government, business could never rise above the pickle barrel case. It's only with a certain amount of government involvement that we reach the era of mass production and supermarkets. Now, I hardly need add that if government goes one inch beyond what is necessary to perform this valuable function for the people, as it has in some times and some places, then indeed it is harmful and stifling. Just one more example of this theory of mutual interest. I think both labor and management in this country have by now pretty well come around to the American philosophy of the mutuality of interest of labor and management. Oh, you see. Contest over wages, the surface contest, is obvious. There's also a contest between a wholesaler and a retailer of a washing machine, or a housewife and a butcher over the price of hamburgers. But that doesn't mean there's a class struggle going on. That doesn't mean that the dearest wish of each party to the bargaining is that the other might be utterly destroyed. You know, Marx, like most writers on economics prior to John Stuart Mill, was obsessed with the idea of distribution. To him, the economic problem seemed to be a great big bag of gold with a capitalist and a top hat and a cigar sitting on it. And the idea was to gather away from them and divide it up with a proletariat. Distribution, redistribution. About this time, Lincoln adumbrated the modern theory, which is that the real secret of prosperity is to increase the total stock of goods for all. Lincoln, in an inimitable way, said, let not him who is houseless cool down the houses enough, but let them labor diligently and build a house for themselves. Let's have two houses where formerly there was only one. That's the American thesis. And then came Henry Ford and his $5 a day voluntary wage, and the American pattern began to emerge. High production, good wages, widespread purchasing power as the mutual goal of employer and employee. And it is this pattern that has set the pace in the world. I said at the outset that what we are for is, in fact, the active, positive force in the world. You know, this idea that socialism and communism are the wave of the future, this is a very old-fashioned idea, clung to by a few propagandists like Christoph and a few people who haven't read their papers since we started Adolf Hitler. Over time, during the Great Depression, and somewhat after, there was a worldwide trend toward nationalization and centralization of economic power and government. But in recent years, the trend has been reversed. The corner has definitely been turned. Those people who assume that what Britain and France did today, the United States must certainly do 10 or 20 years from now, are discovering it the other way around. Look at the evidence. After the war, West Germany launched a lusty private enterprise program and made the swiftest economic progress of any country in the world, including the Soviet Union. Britain, meanwhile, was busily going down the road of nationalization of industry. Took one look around, wasn't getting anywhere, saw what was happening in Germany and elsewhere, and changed his mind and tried frantically to denationalize such as a nationalized industry that could be unscrambled. A public opinion poll was taken by Elmo Roper recently of the 14 major industrialized nations of the free world, including some that we sometimes loosely call socialistic, like New Zealand, Sweden, Australia, and the like. And you know what that poll showed? It showed that only 8% of the people of all these countries were in favor of nationalization, even of major industry. The rest said either leave them alone completely, or at most regulate, but don't try to manage them. In the light of this crushing demonstration of world opinion, what becomes of the idea that the whole world is drifting towards socialism? Matter of fact, the socialists themselves have abandoned socialism. In the West German Socialist Party in 1958, officially renounced state ownership of major industries as a platform and as a plank in its platform. The British Labour Party in 1958 published a plan for progress, which called not for nationalization, but for high investment and expansionism in a capitalist economy. But most striking of all, the communists themselves, the Russian communists, are copying our system. And the areas in which the Soviet Union has had its greatest successes, and it has had success, are precisely the areas in which, to the greatest extent, it has abandoned its own dogmas and copied our country. Let me give three illustrations of this. The first is the principle of incentive. The incentive principle is the very mainspring of private enterprise, always has rewards for energy and ingenuity, penalties for sloth. It is absolutely anathema to true communist doctrine. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need, there isn't an ounce of incentive. What were they doing in Texas? Well, when Christopher was over here a first time, the pleasant time, you know, went to Camp David with President Eisenhower, and the President mentioned afterwards that Khrushchev had actually boasted to him that Russia was applying the incentive principle much more strongly than the United States. Neil Evangelos, in his book, The New Class, mentions that the communist secretary of the Rayon Committee, which is a sort of a middling bureaucrat, I would suppose, gets 25 times the pay of an average worker. The Secretary of State of the United States gets 5 times the pay of the average worker. The Russian communists, ladies and gentlemen, are applying the rawest, crudest 1850 type capitalist incentives that they can devise. And there isn't a labor union in the United States today that would stand for a minute. I was over there a good part of the summer. I went down into the Ukraine and talked to the manager of a kolkhoz, a collective farm, for hours, and got quite an education in the means of compensation. It's used. They have a unit. They call it a day's work. It isn't really a day's work, but it's a unit. And that gets you a certain number of rubles. And all you have to do is keep piling up more units by working all night and all day and getting your aged grandmother and driving her out in the field if you can, and your four-year-old children, anything you can do, just pile up these units and you get more pay. And on top of that, the man with a hoe gets only a small fraction of the unit for the same amount of time as the man on the tractor. So if you can get into all these other categories, you'll get 7 or 8 or more times as much, as many units, you see. And so it goes all through the system. Well, this is incentive, but it certainly isn't coming. Science professors, they tell me, get as much as $40,000 a year, some of them. Artists and ballerinas and others that are useful for cultural and propaganda purposes and others are similarly very highly paid. And I visited some very lovely doctors in the country that would be perfectly the envy of some American industrialists. Cars, places on the Black Sea, and so forth, for the fortune. But at the other end of the scale, what about the people, the proletariat, who are supposed to be the prime concern of this whole ideology? They're paid so little that they each got a bare subsistence. In fact, the farmers don't even have social security in the paradise of socialism. They even carry this incentive business over into grades and schools. You get A's at the university, you get a bigger stipend if you get B's. If you get B's, you get a bigger stipend if you get C's, and so on down the line. I don't know, maybe it's a good idea. My pious, we used to get a nickel if you brought an A home on your report card sometime, but we've never begun to carry out incentives on grades, anything like this. Now, where the incentive principle is operative, you see results. But when these results are held up to the world as evidence of the intrinsic superiority of communist doctrine, then it's time to expose the fraud. The second pilfered principle is freedom of thought. Now, communist tradition, from Marx right on down to Lenin and Stalin, has always called for ruthless suppression and control of thought in all areas. Not just politically, but culturally, architectural, literary, scientific, everything. You'll recall how some years ago, Stalin decreed that Lysenko's theory of genetics was the only true theory, and any other geneticist, a biologist, the laboratory prove something else that better not produce the results if he wanted to live out his lifespan. And several of the leading geneticists of Russia wound up in Siberia because they didn't learn this in time. Well, now, in one area, this dogma of thought control ran head on into another dogma that gradually assumed much greater priority. The need, also supported by writings of Lenin, to strengthen Soviet military and expansionist power through the most advanced weapons that science could produce. Stalin could perhaps play at the game of omniscience about genetics without damaging the arms program. But he could not decree that rocket fuel A satisfies the party line and rocket fuel B violates the party line, not if he wanted to get a rocket off the ground. So, in one carefully circumscribed area, the natural sciences related the first to arms development. The dread virus to free thought is gradually and reluctantly turned loose. And once more we've seen the result. And once more we see the weird upside down claim that satellites and missiles prove the merits of communist doctrine. The third area, borrowed from us, is that of emphasis on productivity, as I mentioned a moment earlier. We're now being challenged by Mr. Khrushchev to a contest to see whether communism or private enterprise is more productive. Now, if Karl Marx were alive today, he would have bet any amount of money in this race on capitalism. You know, economic writers have produced, surprisingly enough, some wonderful examples of rich, beautiful quotes. But none of them can match the almost lyrical praise lavished by Karl Marx in the opening pages of the Communist Manifesto on the inherent productive power of bourgeois capitalism. You get home tonight, get out your copy of the Communist Manifesto and turn to about page 6, and you'll find something like this. The direct quote: the bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than have all preceding generations together. It has accomplished wonders far surpassing Egyptian pyramids, Roman aqueducts, and Gothic cathedrals. It has conducted expeditions that put in the shade all former exhibitions of nations and crusades, and so on and on. You see, what we frequently forget nowadays is that Marx's whole theory was that the downfall of capitalism would come from too much production. And here it is, in another direct quote. He wrote, "Modern bourgeois society, with its relations of production, of exchange, and of profit, a society that has conjured up such gigantic means of production and of exchange, is like the sorcerer who is no longer able to control the powers of the nether world, whom he has called up by his spell. And why? Because there is too much civilization, too much means of subsistence, too much industry, too much commerce." You can be sure that the communists do not choose this as their text when they preach to the underdeveloped nations. I think that the underdeveloped nations would be only too glad to take their chances on too much industry, too much commerce, and too much means of subsistence. So when Mr. Khrushchev boasts boast of the superior productive power of communism. I suggest we simply quote the Communist Manifesto back to him and let it go at that. I'm sure he hasn't read it for years. It seems to me then that we could make no more disastrous mistake than to be lured into Mr. Khrushchev's trap of setting our national objectives in terms of a race with the Soviet Union. We're not starting from the same point. We're not heading for the same goal. How can we be in a race? The problem that obsesses the Russians, sheer quantitative material production, for all practical purposes, we've long since solved. Within that problem, by far the greatest need of the Soviet Union is vastly increased production of food and agricultural products. Well, in this part of the country, I hardly need to ask, what kind of a race does that pose for us? Half of the Soviet people work on farms and produce a diet which is still the worst in Europe. One-eighth of the American people work on the farm. They produce the best diet in the world. They ship millions of tons of food overseas. And they still pile up such mountainous surpluses that it costs $1.5 million a day just to store them. The Soviet government is putting forth frenzied efforts, including copying Iowa farm methods and breaking up the tractor system and imposing a system of rewards and incentives very much like private enterprise, all to increase food production. The American government is also putting forth frenzied efforts, including soil banks, acreage restrictions, payment not to produce, all to decrease food production. Some rate. Naturally, Khrushchev would like to announce a volume of production rate on these terms. You know, he's so imbued with his competitive idea, it confuses everything he does. When he was over here on his trip around the country, remember he was photographed in a packing plant in Des Moines eating a hot dog along with Henry Cabot Lodge, who was also eating a hot dog. And the AP account underneath the picture said, quote, Khrushchev gulped his down in about 3 minutes, beating Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge by a full minute. Well, when the Russians announced then that they were going to try to catch up with us in the production of food and consumer goods and overtake us in even ways so that they go by, let's just say go to it, more power to it. The best hope of peace, in fact, might lie in a genuine period of concentration by the Soviet Union on its internal needs, both because it would distract attention from foreign adventures and because it would increasingly create a body of influential citizens with a strong stake in peace and stability. Now, to say that we have licked the production problem is certainly not to say that we have attained the ultimate in standard of living or in the good life. I don't mean to suggest that. Our economic problem now is quite different. It's one of adjusting demand and distribution to our potential production to get the fullest enjoyment of the things we can produce, and at the same time to use our capacity to help bring the whole world to a higher level. Russia's nowhere near reaching that point and won't be for years. Now, the idea of having goals to bring out the best efforts in you, that's a good one. But the race is not with Russia. rushes puffing mightily along a leg of the race we've long since considered. But that doesn't mean that we should slump idly beside the track. We have a new leg of the race to run. It's hard to run a race, not against an opponent, but against the best that's in you. I don't go to the dog track, but they tell me that even the greyhounds are pulled on to their greatest effort by little mechanical white rabbits that's always out of reach. I do know that a miler will run his best race if he's paced by a 4 quarter mile. But we as a nation have no mechanical rabbit to pull us on. We have no pace setters. We must be our own pace setters. And if we're going to do this, we must once and for all get rid of the idea that we have arrived and that all that remains is for everybody else in the world to catch up with us where we are. The beginning of wisdom here at home is to tell ourselves that we reach only a precarious midpoint in the most radical political economic experiment in history. And that there lie ahead of us, if we can only see them, new picture of season, in the art of living as individuals and as members of a new kind of world order, picture that are as high above today's levels as today's are above those of 1787. And by creating this kind of picture of the past ahead, we'll not only galvanize our own efforts in a way that's truly worthy of our potential, but we'll at last, I think, enlist the understanding and approval of the other nations of the world. You see, there's nothing appealing in appearing before the world in the guise of remote and unattainable good fortune. Far more appealing to appear as a country which, like every other country, is struggling along the road toward a more perfect society that's the common goal of all. So let's lose no time then in proclaiming these new objectives, which are our goals on this leg of the race. They're not, as on the last leg, years in material production, or subduing a raw continent, or exploiting natural resources. Rather, they're greater self-expression, greater cultural and intellectual and religious creativity, refinement and perfection of our freedom, the fullest exploitation of the possibilities of science and intelligence and education, the perfection of economic arrangements, yes, which will not only elicit the increased production we know we're capable of, but distribute in a way that will bring a good life to all our people, and the construction of international devices and institutions that will put the rule of law in the place of the rule of force in international affairs, and set all people on the road to prosperity, fulfillment, personal and national freedom, and enduring international harmony.
A very interesting speech. I'm sure that probably some of the members of our audience would have some questions they'd like to ask of you. If you care to answer them, why, we're ready for them now. Are there some questions? Mr. Klein?
Yes, very definitely. If you've preceded your question, I think, by the very important assuming, and as the days go by, I'm more and more reassured that your assumption will prove to be correct. I think all of us, when the Peace Corps idea was first spoken of, were inspired by it as a brilliant idea, a wonderful new approach to the problem of what we can all do as individuals about these objectives that we all desire so much. I think we were all just a little bit worried, can we really do the job right, or can we administer this kind of thing? I've been watching it fairly closely. I've been associated in various oblique ways with it, certain kinds of consulting assignments and whatnot. And I'm feeling pretty good about it, as a matter of fact. I think the people in charge know what they're doing. I don't think they're going to make some of these mistakes that so many people were afraid they might make. I don't think we're going to have hundreds and hundreds of people suddenly descending on some poor helpless little country. People coming in and say, well, here we are, now what can we do for you, sort of thing, you know. I saw a picture, I think it was in the paper today, or yesterday, of a group going off to the Philippines. Well, they know what they're going to do. They're going to be assistants to people teaching English. And from USIA days, I can assure you, there's no more solid, constructive thing that we can do around the world than help people learn English. Everybody wants to learn English. And we're desperate for the sort of people to teach English. Now, if you select your job assignment carefully, you pick things that the people of the country really want, and they do want English teaching, and there are many other things like this, then I think the people are there will be a splendid contribution to your international understanding. I think if I were going to answer that question on the strength of President Kennedy's most recent speech before the UN, I'd have to say that we are doing very well indeed about saying what we are for. I thought President Kennedy's UN speech was magnificent. And it was magnificent because of this very thing. It had a very constructive disarmament proposal, but it went much further than sheer shedding of armament. He accompanied it with the statement that you can't just get rid of armament, you've got to build something into their place. This is a doctrine that some of us have been working on, and this has been the whole theory of the World Rule of Law Center for the last 3 years. If you can't just get rid of armaments, get rid of tensions, get rid of force, get rid of war, and then leave a vacuum. And we're trying to build up the dispute settling institutions, the rules, law, and all the rest. Because after all, in the story of mankind, you only got rid of force as you put law into its place. There's no substitute. You can see this on television if you want to every night. Ad nauseum, as we see the story of the Wild West endlessly unfolded. You don't get rid of the six shooter just one fine western morning and put nothing in its place. Along come the courageous marshals and sheriffs and citizens, and the rule of law and the courts are strengthened, and then the six shooter disappears. So I think Kennedy expounded this thing beautifully in his UN speech. We've got to build up these institutions for the dispute settling, for peacekeeping, and only then will we have disarmament. In his earlier speech on Berlin, somewhat earlier, I also found several passages along this same line. They weren't quite as conspicuous there, but I certainly jumped out of my seat when I saw them. And there was one in particular. It was absolutely astonishing that most of these people didn't pay much attention to it. Right in the middle of his speech, after telling us that the Berlin situation was so serious that we had to risk even hydrogen war, he said, but if anybody is in doubt about our legal position in Berlin, we're perfectly willing to have it submitted to adjudication. Now this is the biggest dispute of our time, and he's willing to have it impartially decided by a tribunal. So when people say all this business about world rule of law and adjudication of international disputes, that's all right for the little things, you know, the peripheral things. No nation would ever do it as the big thing. Says, yeah, it's the biggest one of all. And then he put in a second statement that we are perfectly willing, as for any future changes, to have it a matter of self-determination. So as the present change, the present right adjudication, as the future right self-determination. Now, I didn't come here to make a campaign speech for Mr. Kennedy, as I'm sure many of you realize. But when he does something that I like, I'm going to be the first to stand up and say, I don't think, personally, that the world government, in any true sense of the world, is a sufficiently serious possibility so that I, myself, want to spend my energies on it. I don't object to other people doing it. In fact, I work very closely with many other groups of people, and numbering among them some of the most brilliant people I know, that ultimately see this as the solution. And they may be right. But the kind of program I'm trying to work on doesn't look quite so far over the horizon, although it may be going in the same direction. I think it's perfectly possible to get most of the essential things that we need to keep the peace without going all the way towards what you might call government, world government. And that's the line we're taking. Now, people who say we have to have world government or we don't really have any law at all, usually overlook two things, or they have a misconception about two things. One is they can't imagine how you can have law, or world rule of law, unless you have a legislature passing the laws. Well, of course, as any lawyer knows, the overwhelmingly largest part of law, as we know it, never has been near a legislature. It's the common law, and this is true also of international law. Customary international law is the oldest and the largest part of the body of international law. You don't have to have a legislature to have law. And on the international scene, we get very much the equivalent of legislation by multi-partite treaties, which have the effect of legislation for many countries at a time. The second misconception is this, that you can't have law unless you've got a policeman with a big club ready to crack you over the head the minute you violate. In other words, some people think there can't be any law without physical enforcement by force. Now, this isn't borne out by the experience of either domestic or international law. Most of us obey the law all the time, pretty much as a habit. It never occurs that we're obeying law because somebody's going to apply physical sanctions to it. You pull up at a crossroads out in the middle of nowhere in the middle of a dark night sometimes, and there's a big sign up there that says, stop. You stop. You're not afraid of getting caught if you don't stop. You don't even think about it. You just stop because the law says stop and you stop. There are many, many motives, of which this is only one, for obeying the law. Some of them are religious, some are ethical, some are habit, some are economic, some are social. You don't want to be an outcast, an outlaw, and so on. Force is just one of many tensions, and it's applicable mostly just a friend of outlaw, the criminal, and not so much just the ordinary people. Well, on the international scene, one of the most amazing things that you find is that it's almost unheard of for the decision of an international court or tribunal to be violated. In the whole history of the International Court of Justice, there's only been one part of one case that's ever been disobeyed. And of the thousands of other cases, of arbitrations, tribunals, mixed commissions, and all the rest, you can't find more than a tiny handful. And there's some very big and important cases among them. And the conclusion seems to me to be this, that if you can get people to accept the body of law, the rules, the principles, feel that they're there, which many countries around the world don't at this moment feel, especially the newer countries. And if you can get them to accept the dispute settling machine, the courts and the tribunals, to the point where they'll allow their disputes to be submitted to their system, then once the decision is rendered, they're in so deep that it's unthinkable not to obey. So if we can bring nations up to this point, and we can without world government, we can perfectly well. If we can bring them up to this point, then I don't think the problem of enforcement or the need for overwhelmingly powerful world government and police force will prove to be as important a factor as is generally assumed. Now, I agree that we should build up the UN police force as much as possible, and build up the effectiveness of the United Nations as much as possible. But I don't think we should adopt the defeatist attitude of all or nothing. If we can't have an all-out world government, it's no use working on the rest of these things. I think that that we can get as much as we need to keep the peace, even though I don't think there's one chance in a thousand within the foreseeable future that Russia and the United States and China and all the other countries of the world and Egypt and Israel will all come together and say we'll abide by the decision of some international legislature, executive, and police force.
Right.
The answer, I think, would be as follows, that you have to build up this habit of resort to law and the tribunals and the rules and so forth, so that you get these disputes settled before they reach the point where they are such a crisis that nobody could afford to let them go to court. Now, you take the case, for example, the closest thing we've had to what you can get was the Suez invasion, closest to the end of World War III in recent times. That could have been submitted to the International Court without the slightest difficulty. It was a justiciable question. It all centered around two contracts, agreements, the agreement between Egypt and the Universal Suez Company and an oil company. I don't know why the British didn't take it to court this time, but they didn't. They wheeled out the gunboats instead. Now, by the time the gunboats were out and the dive bombers were bombing, of course, it was too late to talk about going to court. My idea then is that if we do our work well now, we can bring things to the point where they never get to that point, where the commitment of national prestige and interests have become so great that they can't back out. There's one other factor, however, and this is applicable, I think, to Berlin. One of the tremendous advantages of the legal process, whether it's adjudication, arbitration, or various other dispute settling devices, this is one of the very few ways that you can settle a serious dispute without loss of state. And I wish people would think about this a little more in relation to Berlin. You know, nations get themselves committed on a particular collision course. And then, even though on both sides they would like nothing better than to get out of what they started, they've got all their people at their back, they've got the opposition party at home, snapping at their heels, and if they let their country down and make some political and diplomatic concessions, it's almost impossible back home. You have a parliamentary form of government, and the parliamentary government, let's take the Honduras-Nicaragua boundary dispute, for example. It's been festering ever since before the turn of the century. It involved a large tract of territory called the Mosquito Coast. It doesn't sound very attractive, but it's the third of the territory of one of the countries. Now, they've been fighting about that for 60 some years. They had an arbitration back around 1900. King of Spain was the arbitrator, and one side wouldn't accept the decision. Among other grounds, they contended the King of Spain was drunk at the time he made the award. That was 60 years ago, and they've been fighting ever since. Last year, it finally got around to taking it to the International Court of Justice. And the court decided the case. The parties are both reasonably well satisfied. One of them has lost, but accepted the loss of his grace. But you suppose the government of that country could have gone off to a summit meeting with the other country and said, oh, that's all right, I'll give it away to you. I'll give you half of it even. What's the difference? If he went back home, his government would fall. The opposition party would scream and tear the air, and the government would fall. There's no question about it. They can't make that concession because of the political realities of it. What? Can say, oh, we're going to be civilized, we're going to do this the way people do nowadays, we're going to go to court on the merits. They go back home, even if they've lost, and they say, well, you know, can't win them all. We did the civilized thing, we took our chances, the court held against us, better luck next time. Now, this you can do even with some rather hot international issues. I don't think there was ever a hotter issue in American history than 54, 40, or 5. Certainly we have never had such a lathered up campaign. And this whole country would work up to a war fever. If we didn't get 54, 40 up there on that northern border, we were all going to go up there and fight. The whole presidential campaign centered around this slogan. What happened? We didn't get 54, 40, and we didn't fight. We got 49. It was arbitrary. Now, if we can do things like that, we can still do it. We can still do it. And I think we can do it even as to some of the big interests where our national prestige and interest seems to be very decent to us. This doesn't mean you can solve all the disputes in court. Some you can't. You can solve disputes about your present rights. You can solve the question in Berlin of whether, in fact, if a separate treaty admitted East Germany, our rights of access are lost. This is a present legal question. You can't solve a question such as, shall there be a free city of West Berlin under UN control? That's a change in legal rights. That's a diplomatic and political action. But the legal action can clear the air, can tell you what your present rights are. And once you know what your present rights are, it's much easier to figure out what to do about your future.
I think we'll take one more question and then we'll have to adjourn. Back there, way in the back.
Yeah.
As to the first question, I'd say this is a very unhealthy development for the very reason that you mentioned. It is almost entirely a defeatist, negative approach to the very real problems of the world. It just isn't going to advance our interests at all. They're much too complex for that. Any organization that thinks we can somehow solve the world's problems by destroying the United Nations, for example, which is the only place where there seems to be very much hope left of making any progress, or by invading Cuba with force of arms, or by approaching the problem of living in the same world with the Russians and the Chinese on the assumption that all we have to do is get as tough as we possibly can and somehow everything's going to come out all right. These sentiments are not at all promising. There's nothing in them that I can see that would bring us any near to a solution of our very real problem. In the second part of your question, let me ask you that again. Oh yes, that's a very penetrating question. This is, I think, the main trouble with some of these self-styled patriotic organizations. Their idea of a communist is some of the poor souls and some of the rather repulsive types that we see getting turned out and sent to jail and conducting subversive activity right in our own country. And then I suppose many people think, well, Russia consists of a great big land filled with a couple, hundreds of millions in China of people just like these people who were putting in jail for subversive activity. Well, this isn't quite so. The communists that grow inside communist countries are not quite necessarily the same breed as a particular kind of person who would be quite capable of turning against his own country and seeking to overthrow his own country from within. They're quite different types, and they have quite different motives in many cases. I think for that reason, the second part of your question is a very revealing one. If these people who think that the solution of international problems, vis-a-vis communism, is the same as solving the problem of internal subversion and overthrow of the government, if they could visit some of these countries, deal with them as to international problems, not problems of domestic overthrow of government and life, and see what they're like, I think they'd discover that the people are different, the issues are different, the way to deal with them is entirely different. I think you put your finger on something there, that one of the main problems with Senator McCarthy and many other people like him was that their whole idea of the international world problem of getting along with or somehow working out our troubles with Russia and China and all of this was the same problem as dealing with this poor soul that somehow has turned against his own country and is quite capable of overthrowing his own country. I think the problem is entirely different, and if we approach Russians and communists in positions of power with responsibility directly for their own established government, as if they were the state, as the occasional individual is subversive to deal with, this would be a very serious mistake. We have to deal with them as representatives of the system, their own government, with very real international sanctions and troubles that we're going to have to try to resolve peacefully.
Thank you, Dr. Larson, for a very interesting and challenging speech this evening. I think we will all express our thanks by